What's going on, everybody? Welcome to Whiskey, Web, and Whatnot, your favorite podcast about whiskey, web, and whatnot, with your hosts, Robbie the Wagner and Charles William Carpenter III.
Yeah, I like the other one about whiskey and web better, actually. You this do? One's okay. It's a strong number two for me.
Okay, all right.
The other one is pretty great.
All right, and our guest today is Nathan, is it Sobo? I should have asked beforehand.
Yep, Sobo.
Cool.
Yeah, when my grandfather immigrated, he told him his name was S-Z-A-B-O. It's like a kind of Romanian name, but he said Shabo, and they just wrote down whatever they heard, I guess.
Yeah.
Kept it simple.
That sounds about right. Oh, you're coming in. We'll make the decisions for you.
That sounds hard to spell.
This is who you are.
So we'll just change it.
Yeah.
Cool. Do you want to give a quick intro into who you are and what you do?
Yeah. So who am I? I mean, I am very much defined by my work. So what I do is very much who I am. Like, it's a big part of my life. I'm one of those types of people. So I work on code editors, and I have for a really long time. It started as like, oh, I want a little of this editor, a little of that editor, and some of my own ideas. But none of these are like quite the thing I want. And that was like 2006. And I haven't been working on editors the whole time, but I've been thinking about it and dreaming about it for most of that time, and then working on them quite a bit. I was one of two of the founding members of the team that built Atom at GitHub, and then didn't have it out of my system and got to a point with Atom where I was like, this doesn't represent what I've learned doing this, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to precipitate the knowledge and the ideas in a higher fidelity form. And so started Zed, which is what I'm doing now, a new code editor. It's written in Rust. Our focus is on performance, minimal design, and then we've also built the entire tool around being multiplayer. So the idea being able to, right now, it's really good at pulling people in real time and just talking through code or working on code together. But our aspirations are to go further and have like text-based collaboration as well, just built right into the editing experience.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, we'll dig into some whiskey, but I've got some questions around that.
Shit. Should I hold off on? I mean, I started drinking the whiskey that these guys shipped me before I even got on the phone with them. They're like, we really usually pour on air.
Can you do a quick purge? You know, a quick run to the restroom and purge, and so we can start over? I think it'll be fine.
I'm only a few sips in.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I've been like, yeah, just working a lot, and then I had my kids, and so it's like big context shift, and so an excuse to drink whiskey in the afternoon and call it work is like just what the doctor ordered right now.
Right.
Yeah, that's why we do this.
I was going to say, you have just revealed the impetus of this entire podcast. It's secondhand to anyone listens to it at all. All of it is about that and context shift. So we can empathize with that. I also have two young kids, and you know, you got to go from one to the other somehow.
Yeah, or recover from the process of doing so.
Right, yeah.
I think it's kind of where I'm at right now.
Yeah, the end is possibly too, yeah. All right. So today we're having the Redbreast Kentucky Owl edition, which is, I can't confirm this, but I believe it is their 12-year.
It's not Kentucky Owl.
Not Kentucky Owl. Sorry. Kentucky Oak.
That's another brand. It's Kentucky
Owl. Kentucky Owl is a brand. That's a brand. I haven't even had any yet. Exactly. There's a bird on the front. There's all these things. Redbreast is not an owl, though.
Yeah.
Kentucky Oak edition. Thank you for the clarification. I cannot confirm whether it's a 12-year or not, but I think it starts with their 12-year distillate. It's 101 proof.
Yeah.
It's made from malted and unmalted barley and triple distilled in copper pot stills, which is pretty normal for an Irish whiskey. And then it's finished for a minimum of 4 months in hand-selected air-dried American used oak barrels. And Whiskey Advocate score of 96 was number two on the top 20 whiskeys of 2022.
Okay.
I don't know. Didn't know that, but hey, why not?
No idea.
Yeah. Ooh.
Smells good.
Kentucky Oak.
Yeah. So That means, it has to be Kentucky oak is probably like a correlation to bourbon barrels. So it has to be in brand new American charred oak barrels. Bourbon has to be like federally regulated. Not that Irish does, but.
Do they ever make whiskey in French oak or is that only wine?
You can make whiskey in French oak. You can't make bourbon in French oak.
Yeah. So.
I see.
And it wouldn't be advised because it wouldn't put enough oak into it.
Yeah.
Because French is less oaky.
It's just a little too soft.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's seen where it's been finished in like French oak barrels, though, that were used with something else, but never like the first time around.
You can tell I'm more educated about wine than whiskey, although neither is like a particular expertise, but I enjoyed hearing that description. Triple the still.
Yeah.
That's the typical Irish maneuver.
Yeah. They'll keep running it through, just trying to make it a bit cleaner and cleaner each time and reduce the heads and tails, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So I'm smelling some new Nike shoes with popcorn in them.
Wait, are they Jordans or Bo Jackson's? Because I don't know.
They're neither.
Oh, bummer. See, I smell a Bo Jackson, the black colorway. Mm. You know, the Raiders colorway. So
whenever my girlfriend tastes like any red wine with like tannic structure, she's like, tastes like erasers. I hate this.
Oh, interesting.
So
I love that though.
I don't know. I like it though.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. I love like, look, they're personalized descriptors, right? Because like this pseudo agreed upon vernacular across alcoholic beverages that reaches into things like tennis balls, fresh open thing of tennis balls was a thing I saw in a documentary once. Like
that is a distinct smell,
right?
It's a good smell.
Yeah, I think it's a good smell. I don't know if I want to drink that, but you know, I can. I like the smell.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a pencil shavings and weird stuff like that I've heard. I don't know. This one actually smells a little like vanilla extract to me. Mm. Like it's a little sweet, but like an essence of it. And then you know if you just drank
it. Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah, I get a lot of that up front.
I like it.
So Irish whiskey tends to be pretty mild, too. And so, you know, it's smooth and easy drinking regardless.
But this is higher proof and also an American oak, so.
Yeah, I would expect that to give it a little spice. I get a smidge of it, but.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I think it's got a lot more flavor than most Irish I've had.
Yeah.
Irish can tend to be not as much as the, like, Japanese ones that were literally somehow, like, drinking water. But it's, like, it's more towards that where it's, like, not as complex.
Yeah.
And they want it to be smooth, but this has some more complexity, so I'm a fan of that.
I get a little orange in the beginning, like orangey, orange rind kind of thing. And I get some cinnamon or something on the finish of it. So
I can taste all of that now that you've mentioned that.
That's what I'm here for.
You tasting the Nikes?
I'm just closing my eyes and tuning in.
Yeah, yeah. And see if you can pick that up and once I've implanted it into your brain.
I'm definitely tasting alcohol.
Yeah.
Well, that's all right. And as long as it's pleasant, you know, that's kind of a thing.
It's half the battle.
It's awesome.
So we give it a really distinct rating system. So it's 1 to 8 tentacles. Robbie and I will like categorize whiskeys just because we've had so many, but you don't really need to. You can just say based on other whiskeys I've had.
Okay.
1 being like, this is gross. I don't want it anymore. 8 being, I don't want anything else. This is amazing. And obviously everything in between. So yeah.
So one whiskey that was really memorable for me is GitHub had a barrel of Four Roses made, or I guess they ordered a barrel and then they bottled it in the typical Four Roses bottle, but they made their own label.
Cool.
And so I don't know. I think it must have had a lot to do with just the emotional impact of getting that bottle and how cool that was. But I really liked that whiskey. So it was Four Roses single barrel.
Mm-hmm.
But then I've had a bunch of other whiskeys that I still liked them all right, but I would put this like a close second behind that one.
Nice. So would you maybe give it a 7?
6, 7 tentacles.
Yeah.
But I don't know how to categorize it. It's drinkable.
No, it could be all whiskeys. When you think about whiskey,
yeah.
You know, what would you pick up? Like if someone was to say, hey, pick your favorite, you probably would pick that sentimental bottle. And then they would say, okay, well, it's not a special occasion. Then what might you have? You might go this direction, right? So I think about it in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just categorize because we've done 90 whiskeys now.
Whoa!
You're fine.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we have to differentiate a bit.
Is this episode 90?
It is. Well, no.
You think we'd be better at this?
I guess we're on a delay. So there's like ones that haven't been published yet. Mm. The next one to come out will be 90. This is 92, I think.
Mm. Mm. My gosh.
93?
92 like bottles that. Of whiskey on the wall. Yeah. Well, yeah, I love that. I also love Four Roses Single Barrel. That's like a regular go-to sipper and recommendation for folks. Like, it's a strong bourbon. It's got a lot of spicy notes to it, a lot of roundness. I've been to the distillery a couple of times and done tastings and stuff. It's a beautiful place. Highly recommended. I'm from Kentucky originally, too. So, you know, I had access.
My grandma's from there. Yeah. She talked about it a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I was in the north, you know.
She was a hillbilly.
Oh, see, I'm those.
That's what she says.
Yeah, yeah. I know plenty of hillbillies, but I lived in the north, right on the river, actually, Ohio River, across from Cincinnati. So it's way more urban, but I had connections to both sides.
Yeah.
Isn't the river just made of chili?
I wish. We'd go swim in the river of Cincinnati chili.
Yeah.
But that's for another episode, I suppose. I'm going to get to the business, Robbie. Okay. Stop trying to distract me. So yeah, for me, in terms of Irish whiskeys, I've had a couple other red breasts that I really love on their own though. The 15 is a great, great one. There's a Teeling rum barrel finished one that I really enjoy too. Would recommend.
A rum barrel.
Rum barrel finish.
So rum was previously fermented in the barrel?
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's cool.
Yeah. So they would have aged rum in there first and they just used it to finish for a few weeks or a couple months. And oh man, it's good.
It's really interesting.
So given those would be a little higher for me. I'm going to give this a 6. I enjoy it though quite a bit. I might even try to figure out how to put a little water in here to open it up some more. But yeah, this is an easy drinker. It's got good flavor. It's
not- I'm having it on ice. I don't know if that's sacrilege, but probably is.
It's fine.
Not for our guests. Only for Robbie.
Yeah.
Robbie knows better.
He used to give me tons of shit for doing it before. Because like the first at least 10 episodes, I would always did ice. And Chuck would comment on it every single time and be like, you can't do that. And I'd be like, okay, so I'm not going to do it anymore. But yeah, it's fine to do whatever, however you like it.
I just said, taste it first and then add your ice. That's what I said. Taste it first and then add your ice.
Yeah.
You know,
that's fair.
Figure out how they expected it to taste out of the bottle.
Right.
And then be like, okay, I'm going to have it the way I like. I mean,
yeah.
I've given this advice a few times that I was given on a distillery tour once. Old man doing the tour, super nice, whatever else. But he's like, the best whiskey is the one you like. Is it $20? Is it $300? Whatever. Is it on ice? Is it like, it's your stuff. This isn't, you know, some sort of aficionado parade here. Like, have it how you enjoy it. That's the whole point in the end.
Yeah.
And as you have it more, what you'll enjoy will probably change. That happened with me with wine, which I am more familiar with drinking, you know?
Yeah.
But I always found it kind of pretentious, that whole world. But it feels less pretentious as I drink it more, I guess, and realize these people are like referencing something that is a reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not like they're like totally making it up, but it does feel like people can kind of get a little pretentious sometimes around this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Around anything like that.
I think they can. I think that when you can go into spending hundreds and thousands of dollars on a bottle and go down that kind of path of things.
Whoa.
Right. Like that's one area of it. And you can do that in whiskey too. So, you know, there's anywhere you want to spend money. Commerce exists in the world. But conversely, if you just want to have some enjoyable beverage, alcoholic beverage or not, or whatever, like there'll be approachable things at various price points. I think you can get a $15 to $20 bottle of wine that is excellent.
For sure.
I've done it before.
Yep.
Especially in Italy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so good in Italy.
Oh, man.
We'll come back to that.
We're going to have to come back to this.
I'm going
to
give this a 7. I think it's pretty good.
Yep.
All the reasons you said.
Excellent.
I don't really have anything to add.
All right. We'll talk a little tech before we have too much.
I could talk tech in any state, just to be clear. We'll see. You could rate my on 1 to 8 tentacles tech talk.
Oh, I love it.
All right.
At the end.
Okay.
All right.
Yes, we'll do this.
So tell us about Zed. Like, what made you want to make a new editor? How's it different?
So big part of Zed was born out of like frustration with web technology. That was like one big pillar of it where, I mean, I don't know if people know this, but we created Electron to make Atom. That's why it's called Electron, because it was like the shell of Atom. And back then it was like this cool idea. Like what we wanted to do was create like the modern Emacs. And so the cool thing about Emacs is like everything's written in Emacs Lisp, and it has this tiny core that's written in C. But then you can like extend the editor while the editor is running. And we got really inspired about that and felt like, okay, to build the modern Emacs environment, like you need to use JavaScript and web technologies and the DOM. And like, it's this incredibly malleable environment where you can just like throw on some CSS, screw with nodes. And like, that felt like the way to do modern Emacs. The funny thing is, like, there was this joke about Emacs 8 megs and constantly swapping, which you can see the joke originated at a time when 8 megs was a lot of memory. But the point is, like, that approach consumed a lot of resources, at least for a particular point in time. And so the downsides of writing an editor in web tech was that the browser foundation, Chromium, basically, like, it's a pretty serious, like, piece of overhead to carry to deliver a very particular experience. So, like, what the web excels at is being very broad. You could do so many different things, and nobody has to install it. It just works. But, like, okay, when you're building a desktop app in web tech, the nobody has to install it strength isn't as high, although it cross-platforms, obviously awesome. And then what we realized was, like, even though we really wanted to let people go broad, actually, like, a code editor is a pretty, like, particular experience. It's a very focused type thing. And so, I don't know, at some point in Atom, I just was running up against these constraints. Like, I'd look at the profiler in the Chrome DevTools and just be like, where is the time going? It's just like slipping through my fingers. Like I can't find any low-hanging fruit to pick anymore. And it's still not as fast as I want it to be. And then I'm pausing and collecting garbage at random times. I don't like that. And so at some point, I just kind of threw up my hands and said, like, I have to start over. And so I started this project called X-Ray because I didn't really think it was appropriate for me to call it Atom 2.0. Like that would have Osborne Atom. And like nobody had really approved that. But it was kind of this little experimental project of like, let's learn or let's see what can we do with Rust? How much better of an editor can we build? And of course, one of the first things that we came to contend with is like, well, I mean, the first thing I contended with is that the learning curve for Rust was, yeah, I describe it as like a vertical cliff with like snakes nesting in the rocks biting me as I ascended it. And there were times when I'm like, can you even build anything fucking useful with this language? Like it's so like the constraints of the borrow checker and the ownership model and everything were such a bitch at first, especially for trying to build a UI. But when we finally kind of like learned to think like the borrow checker and like learned how Rust wanted us to do stuff and stopped trying to take things we learned from writing in garbage collected, memory managed languages and kind of embraced it, which involves some innovation, I think, and some new, at least for us, we didn't see any ready-made formulas for building a UI in Rust. But as soon as we kind of figured it out, I felt like we had ascended the cliff and we were standing at the top, just like looking out over the promised land, kind of like it was just like, holy shit, this is an absolute super weapon. So that was one big piece. And then the other big piece was just kind of finishing the collaborative dimension that I'd always intended to be in Atom, and we just never really got around to it. Yeah, to make an editor that acknowledges that you're working with other people and you got to talk to them. You probably need to talk to them about code and you probably need to have conversations that are more nuanced than are really possible by like hanging comments off of version control artifacts.
Oh, for sure. You need
your conversation to be embedded in the code. So that's the other big piece.
Yeah, and I think in the heavily remote collaborative world of tech where we're at right now, like that kind of tool is pretty useful instead of trying to combine some other things. I mean, I know VS Code has some kind of collaborative plugin. I know there's some things like Tuple and Screen, I think. Screen is still around. I don't know. It was Pop and then it was, or it was Screen, then was Pop or something like
that. Screen Hero, you mean? That was what
Slack acquired.
But. Oh, yeah. Back in the day. I was actually on their like landing page for a little while, Screen Hero.
That guy started a new one, though. He like, remember he started?
Yeah, Pop. Yeah.
Pop. Yeah. I feel like it was Screen at first and then became Pop. And he's like, yeah, I'm doing this again because they buried it.
Was it called Screen first?
It was called Screen. Maybe it was. Became Pop. And he was like, yeah, I'm doing this again because they acquired and buried it and whatever else. So, yeah, I mean, collaborative tools are highly necessary. I want to regress back to two different things that you mentioned. First of all, around the decision to do something, you know, just clean slate Rust. Did you make that decision before or after your time at Warp?
I made that decision well before my time at Warp. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. A lot of Warp basically is Zed in a lot of ways. It's like an early prototype of Zed. And when I was leaving GitHub, I don't know. I had never raised money. I had never contemplated starting a company. And I'd been thinking about it a lot. But I don't know. I was reticent. And so when somebody was like, oh, we want to build this terminal. We want to do it this. And so at that, I think the point they talked to me, they were using Electron. And I was like, no. I don't think you should use Electron. I think you should use Rust. We had the UI framework. We had an editor. There were some issues, but yeah, we had the foundations. And then I joined, and my plan was I was going to kind of head engineering there. So I licensed them that tech. They're like, well, I don't know. I'm not going to join a company and not do it the way I think it should be done. And I had all that code there. So that's what we did. And then I realized like 3 months in, I want to do my own thing. Like, I don't know. I've been at GitHub for 9 years. And so anyway, Bitcoin was like going crazy and everything was going crazy. And I'm like, okay, like I've got enough savings that I can kind of just do this. Like, I don't know where this is going to go. It's probably going to be hard to raise money, but I'm going to just quit and do this and see what happens. And I had money raised in like 2 weeks. But I didn't know that was going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. And in retrospect, maybe I should have known. Like, oh, duh. But that's not where my head was at. I'd assumed that raising capital was like, I don't know, you were like walking up and down Sand Hill Road, you know, crying for 3 months. I don't know. That's what I envisioned it. And it was really easy, at least in spring of 2021, when like, everyone was just throwing money into the sky.
When money was still free.
Yeah.
I'm sure many people will have that experience that you were expecting. So, you know, sometimes timing, luck, the right thing at the right time has a lot to do with it. But good for you that you didn't have to go through that. I'm glad you brought up Bitcoin. I thought I was digging something up because a lot of your old tweets were around Bitcoin and stuff. And I was like, oh, I wonder, are you still into that? But we'll get there eventually. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense where like, that could inform your next steps, kind of like looked into another thing, went somewhere else. I was curious where the influence was there around Warp. And, you know, we talked to Zach months ago or something, like maybe last year.
A while ago.
But yeah, Rust is the right choice for a lot of things. So that's cool.
Definitely for a tool like this.
Yeah. Electron, though, lives and breathes all kinds of applications, right? You know, it's like tons of stuff there.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, you had no idea where that was going to go. We built a thing in Electron, you know, open source color management app or whatever else. So we've had some experience there.
Yeah. How else do you build apps for Linux? Like, no one's doing that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, to really do anything else is kind of what we're doing. And, like, I was afraid to do what we're doing. Even when we started X-Ray, the plan was, we're going to do the UI in Electron. And then when we kind of rebooted X-Ray after, you know, Microsoft acquired GitHub and like I went on paternity leave for a while. When I came back, it was kind of like, you can't work on this anymore. And so I stopped it and we started, well, for a while I tried to let it go, but I just couldn't get excited about doing anything else because anytime I would start writing software again, I'd be in an editor I didn't love and I'm like back to the same freaking problem. It's just staring me in the face.
Yeah,
like I can't get away from this. So anyway, we tried to use Electron even for a little bit after we rebooted X-Ray and like started over on our own time. And it would just feel like we worked so hard to get this performance in the Rust piece. And then we would just kind of piss it away on abstractions that make a lot of sense when you're looking to be very cross-platform, move fast, be malleable. But they didn't matter to us enough. Like, we were committed to building an editor, and like, I didn't care if I had to paint the text on the screen exactly where I wanted it. Like, none of those things mattered to me. All that mattered was speed. But I was like, I can't build a UI framework. Like, that's crazy. I can't do that. So I looked at Flutter, but I'm just like, this isn't. At the time, the desktop offering felt really like experimental, and it was Dart, which was like, I want to write Rust. At that point, I was like really excited about Rust. And so little by little, like the Electron, you know, used to like spit JSON at Electron, and then it morphed into spitting data at the GPU.
Mm, interesting. Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, I could see like, why force something that isn't giving you your intended output, which sounds like something that's fast as possible, and trying to make those connections. It's like, oh, well, I'm sacrificing something here. So why not just stay at the source?
Yeah, exactly. So like when we lay out, or, you know, when we get to get like pixels on the screen, we have an element tree, which is very much inspired by React, where there's just this tree of elements that we want to render. The cool thing is though that you can program your own element. So it'd be as if you could write div, and then you write layout and you write paint. And so you're controlling in this very imperative way how the element decides to take up space, and then exactly how the element and whatever data is associated with it maps to geometry in this like scene object that's ultimately what our shaders consume to render pixels on the screen. And so you have this very like low level imperative control over exactly how things are laid out and painted. But then we also have stuff like Flex, and this is all a crib from Flutter, but you know, then it's evolved in its own direction. So anyway, in React, you're like diffing a virtual DOM against the previous virtual DOM, and then that's computing like updates to a document object model. What we do is like we lay it out and then we just paint it. And it turns out that like on even on an integrated GPU on a modern machine, you could easily repaint the entire window with extremely low latency. And we could do more sophisticated approaches that only invalidate part of the window buffer, et cetera. But like, we're not even doing that yet. That'd be more power efficient, but like we're well below the time needed to deliver the frame rate required to like saturate the capabilities of the hardware of the display. Anyway, that's what you get out of kind of cutting out the bullshit and just going straight to what you want. But it comes at a cost, obviously. Like, it took us a while and we're still investing in that. So it's been a journey.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So like, you know, obviously all of this performance is like top of mind for everything. I'm wondering, you know, what the future plans are for like, will there be a plugin system or anything like that? And, you know, how does that affect performance as you start to layer things on?
Yeah, it's a great question. And performance is a big question as we consider plugins. So on our roadmap for kind of the coming months is to make languages extensible. So that's like only a baby step toward a plugin system, but it will kind of lay down some infrastructure for us. So the pieces of that is TreeSitter is one, which is our parsing framework, which is a separate conversation. But to actually interface to the language server, we have like a tiny adapter trait object in Rust that's got, you know, a handful of methods around how do you like check for updates to the language server? How do you download a new one? How do you start it? We clean up some data coming out of the language server. And that right now is like compiled into the binary, right? So we have support for Rust analyzer and the Python language server, TypeScript, et cetera. That is the first thing that we want to make pluggable in WebAssembly, because it's just a really, really simple, teeny little piece place to start. But what it will drive out is, what is running WASM inside of Zed look like? What's the packaging format going to look like? How are these things distributed? Just figuring that all out will be like a first step. And then doing TreeSitter, which is also going to be organized around WASM. I think the plan right now is like TreeSitter is compiled. Basically, it's like what TreeSitter's job is to do is to take like a JSON description of a language grammar and spit out a C program that parses it. But the cool thing is Max has come up with this way of basically taking the parse table, which is just like a giant bunch of C like literals, and copy it out of a WASM binary directly into our native heap, and then using that to drive the parser on like our native side, like not through WebAssembly. But then we call back into the WASM binary to do lexical scanning. Because you can imagine that like lexical scanning is like kind of Turing complete. It's an arbitrary function. Like in Python, you need to like figure out the indentation level and like kind of insert closing brackets when the indentation level drops. Mm-hmm. And in Ruby, God only knows what you do in the freaking parser for Ruby. So that's the beginning of it. But WebAssembly, you know, then from there, I'm hoping that we can start to add more surface area and figure out, okay, now that we've got the basics, like you could at least bring your own language, what else do people want to do? What's kind of the intersection of what's really stable API-wise inside the product? What would be easy to open up an API to that we're not going to have to change anytime soon? And what do people want? And try to find the Venn diagram of those two things and then just grow from there.
Yeah.
So that's the plan.
Okay. That's essentially what I grokked from your Hacker News post when you were kind of announcing all of this and what would be the API for composability and flexibility or whatever over time, and how maybe that was some of the issues that you had with Atom. It was a little kind of too open, and so it limited you as you were working on it. And so like you're trying to think of it from the other side of it. Like that's what I gleaned from that. So that when you describing this kind of like makes a whole lot of sense. Like you're very pursuant upon the performance aspect, and then obviously the ability to collaborate
right
in this tool. And then extension is kind of something else.
Yeah. But I mean, one thing I want to say around extensions, like, is I do like giving people power. But what I've learned from Atom is that if you just give people power with no responsibilities, you know, people are going to abuse it. They don't care. They're busy. They're in a hurry. It doesn't matter to them. It works for them. And then they publish extensions that degrade the experience. And then once you've got a bunch of extensions installed, like, okay, which is the extension that's causing you to have a slow experience in some corners? You don't care. It's just the thing feels slow and that's your experience. And so like ultimately we're responsible for the user's experience. And that means like we got to transfer some of that responsibility onto the package authors. And so I think if we put you on the main thread, which I'm not opposed to, we're going to give you a deadline. Like you need to respond, and we'll see how this goes over, but I want to try it. Like you need to be done in like 200 microseconds. Or whatever your budget is, and maybe the user could choose a budget, or I don't know. And if you go over, like, we just disable your extension or something until the user's got to go click a button and, like, turn it back on next to the, like, open issue button so that we're really defending the user, you know. And then if you set the bar high, I think people will meet it.
I think if you quote the Spider-Man meme,
yeah,
as you almost did,
yeah,
with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah,
exactly. Uncle Ben, he knew what was going on. Not the rice guy, the other one. Spider-Man.
Isn't it just Ben's now? Or like...
Oh, I don't know.
It's not Uncle Ben anymore or something, I think.
I don't know.
I don't buy a lot of rice.
I buy rice at Costco.
Exactly. I buy Kirkland rice. I don't know.
I don't have a Costco membership. Can't do it.
Oh, man.
Because it's too far, right? Because you live on a farm.
Well, everything's too far. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, everything.
You grow your own rice.
Exactly.
I should. I should, though.
It's got rice paddies out in Virginia. I don't know if that's the same, like, climate or whatever. And then here, I'll go further down the spiral and really throw us off. I just was reminded, like, the other day. So on the weekends when I'm doing house chores, like, outside or whatever, when it's not 115 degrees, I wear overalls. I have some overalls. It's like grandpa or whatever else. Just
ooh, I'm going to need a picture of this.
We'll see. Because you'll publish it. So I'll show you. I'm not giving you any assets.
Just tweet it at me.
So I wear these overalls. I think overalls are cool too. So whatever. Wear my overalls. And my daughter now recently, every time I put them on, she's like, Daddy, that's wrong. That's for farm. Because she has like a little farm playset. And the farmer is wearing overalls. She's like, no, that's wrong. I'm like, what do you mean? It's, you know, I'm going to go work in the garden or wherever else. She's like, no, that's for farm. Anyway,
how old is she?
She's not wrong.
She's four. She just turned four last week.
Okay, perfect.
Yes, so it's great. The first time she did it, like a couple months ago, it was like I lost it. But anyway, I digress.
Where were we
before that?
Yeah.
Wasm and plugins, collaboration.
Yes, extensibility and controlling certain, like having a responsibility to the users, having an API that maybe has limits, but prioritizing collaboration and speed.
Absolutely. But I mean, extensibility for a long time was something I was just like, I don't even want to think about that right now. Like we've got to get the core experience good.
Right.
Because another thing I learned with Adam is like, cool, you want to put all your investment into extensibility and like it takes a lot of time. And after you sync all of that investment in, now you got to have other people build on top of what you've done to produce the thing that the user actually ultimately experiences. And, you know, ultimately people did do that with Adam, but like, it was just like, ugh. I don't know. I had a team at Facebook building developer tools for all of Facebook that were very particular to their needs. And I'm like, this team's like five times the size of the Adam team. Like, help.
Yeah.
Like, so I don't know. I just really wanted to like focus on, let's have a really good like out of the box experience. And we're getting there, but we still have a ways to go. But now I'm starting to think more about extensibility. Because like one of the biggest feedback is like, can you support Vue? Can you support Svelte? Can you support PHP? Like it just goes on and on. And I don't know. It's funny because the received wisdom is like, you got to focus. But like, I don't know. What I'm hearing is all these people who want to use Zed, we don't support them right now. And like we use TreeSitter, we use the language server protocol. Both are totally language agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we're doing it. We're going to make languages extensible. I think it makes sense.
I'm sure you'll get there at some point. And I maybe even like just chipping away one at a time or something, big community.
Oh, we're doing it now.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe
we're building the extensibility now.
Yeah, support Rust.
Yeah.
You know, there you go. There's your start. You're built in Rust, support Rust. Go from there.
That's built in, Rust Analyzer.
Nice.
And I think we're pretty good at Rust.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously when you're bootstrapping and building a company, it's like, you know, you got to support the bigger things first. And like, I mean, Svelte is getting bigger. Vue, I guess, I don't know. I don't know if Vue is growing or not, but like the problem I have is I use Ember and no one uses Ember. So like nothing supports Ember. So like I'm always screwed, but like, yeah, prioritizing who gets what is like, you almost have to make it a community thing because
exactly
there's always going to be a new framework that comes out that's like, oh, hot new thing.js and like, oh, you don't support it already? Like, what are you doing? Like, Right. Okay, well, we'll make it extensible so that you can do that. Like, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, who knows? I mean, the one thing I am learning about all this is like, to me, the optimal path, like if I look for 20 miles in any direction, I see shit that would be a really good idea to add to Zed. Finding the optimal path through that is daunting. And I don't think it's really knowable, if that makes sense. Like how would I even look back and assess? But we'll see. Ultimately, like we'll sink the time into doing it. But I don't know. It's hard to ignore from so many people that they want extensibility and they want all these languages supported. And hear that over and over and over again and not respond to it. Like,
right. It's almost like squeaky wheel syndrome though, right? Like you subjectively hear just the loudest voices who are coming to you on these things, but it doesn't always, that doesn't necessarily represent the majority need or demand. And sometimes people are like, I wish it did this and they don't tweet you or something, you know, like, who knows?
Well, and ultimately, like, that's why we're not going to only do the things that people ask for.
Yeah.
But I do want to loop that in because, it's tricky to figure out from a big group of people. I mean, maybe you guys have tips on it. Like, how do you get an understanding as to what the hell is going on with this group of people using your product? I mean, one thing that we did is we just added, like, send us your feedback. And you click it and it opens a buffer. And it's like the absolute minimal friction. You could type like three words or you could type, I don't know, there is a limit on it, but you could type a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So then we got like, you know, 1,250 pieces of feedback from people. And something I like about that is like, it's so easy. Like the barrier to sending that is like trivially low. You're not like navigating through issues on GitHub or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now the burden's on us to understand it. So like we're kind of in the process of doing that. But Joseph on our team is helping me spin up this thing where we're just like batch as much of it as we can into GPT-4 and like have it like boil it down and then link back to the primary sources. So we're able to like dive in and get more detail, but it just is helping us like wrap our head around it. So, but even that, I mean, and then we have quantitative information as well, but ultimately like we also have to trust our own intuition and just like what we want to do.
Yeah. There you go.
What do we want? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. How does, when you start to analyze that from a human perspective and not from the AI perspective, like what, you know, what hits for you? What like makes you excited to work on next and that kind of stuff? I think that plays a part too.
Huge part.
Remember like a few years ago, everybody was shooting stuff through Watson for sentiment analysis?
I did not know that.
Oh, no?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I worked in media for a little while and stuff.
I saw like a couple of those things.
Yeah, yeah. But I worked in media for a little while, and that was like a big part of like AI like plays into news posts and things of that nature, and comments like feed a bunch of comments in based on this like this article and get an overall sentiment analysis of how people felt about it. And it feels like there's an actual parallel there because people get really jazzed or incensed about their tools. Mm-hmm. You know this because you've you know, worked on it because of that.
Yeah.
Right. You have an emotional connection to your tools, and developer experience has become like such an important thing to look at now. That's why these things are important. So, yeah, I almost would like parallel it to that is I'm asking for feedback about the tool and you're getting comments and there's sentiment related to that. And there's commonality in terms and keywords and all that kind of stuff. So hopefully the old GPT-4 is giving you some of that.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not literally being like GPT-4, tell us what to build, but I'm being like GPT-4. What critical things are the people who love the product saying? Like, that's a really important signal for me.
Right.
Of like, okay, you love the product, but you still
mass parse information, right?
Yeah. But then we're still going to ultimately do what we think is the right thing to do. Mm. And that's up to us. And a lot of that is about our own agenda, because I think like it's gotten us this far. It's gotten me this far. I didn't like lick my finger and figure out which way the wind was blowing to like start working on Zed. I did it because I wanted to do it and I didn't even know why I wanted to do it. So I think we got to keep that mentality alive, but I don't want to be like myopic and self-centered and not listen at all either. It's got to be this balance between those two somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah. You had an itch and it's just kept you going. It's kept you
itchy.
Obviously it's like kept you motivated. Right. And that matters. Yeah. That's like interesting. Where does Zed come from? I want to know where Zed comes from. Because all I can think about is Pulp Fiction.
Because it's a Zeditor.
Yeah, Zed is dead, which is like what I hope nobody will ever say. You know, it's like not the greatest association.
Yeah, we also hope that.
But Zed is kind of an homage to the editor, Ed. I don't know. I've always like been really captivated with like the early history of computing. And like there's like this photo of Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie. And they're like next to a big PDP-11 cabinet, and they're like one of them, I don't remember which one, is like working on a teletype machine and just like coming to the realization like, holy shit, these guys were like coding Unix on a machine that didn't even have like a display. Like they were literally editing code on like a teletype printer with like no interactivity whatsoever. So, you know, there's this editor, Ed. It's one of the first editors. And like, I was like, maybe I should call it Ed. You know, I was just like driving. I think I was biking around Boulder one day thinking about what did I want to call this project that I was working on. I'm like, but then realized like, oh, Ed is like still ships with like Darwin. Like you can type Ed and it pulls up an editor. And so I knew that the editor would need a like, whatever, mate or subble or code or what you needs a command line tool. And so I'm like, well, I don't, it would be really rude to like pay homage to Ed by calling the editor Ed and then clobbering the command that runs the program. And just kind of like, so started thinking, okay, well, what could we call it? And you know, there were a lot of bad options, but Zed was the one that I liked.
That stuck.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. And that's a French for Z in the alphabet. I mean, there's a whole lot of other correlations, right? And that also with the Z and the color blue that you're using makes me think of Steve Zissou. So maybe you can get a red beanie with that on the front. And then that will be some cool swag too, with like homage to Wes Anderson films. I don't know. It's cool.
Thanks.
That's my weird roundabout way of saying, like, actually, it's pretty cool. I like that. And there's all these other correlations to it. So,
and the cool thing was, is like, we needed a domain. And, you know, I was looking around and Zed.dev was taken. But I emailed the person and I just tried to play it cool because I didn't want to let on that we had gotten funding and needed a domain name, because then what would you do, right?
Then they know you've got cash piles. You're going to be like, great, give me some of those. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I talked back and forth with this guy in the UK. I don't remember his name, but the domain transfers and I'm like, okay, thank God, you know, like, we really needed this domain. Like, I couldn't come up with any other domain that would be reasonable. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, by the way, like, huge fan of Adam. Excited to see what you do. Like, he knew who I was the whole time.
That's awesome.
And he sold me the domain at cost. It was like such a cool moment of like.
He did you a solid. Yeah. That is cool.
What a stand-up guy.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
I wish you knew his name now. Before, I was like, we're hiding from him. No, now we want to.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I really should know his name. I'm like, well, whatever we build, like, you have lifetime access to it. Like, whatever you want to do, you know, like, appreciate that. Yeah.
I'm sure you have old emails or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I would have been like, hey, cool, big fan of Adam. Give me 10 grand.
Like, totally.
Yeah.
Don't buy domain names, TLDs, from Robbie. That's what you learned.
I don't have any good ones to sell you. Sorry.
I don't either. Yeah.
If I did, I'd be making money.
I don't need any other ones, luckily.
Yeah.
I'm good for now.
The best one I had for a while, and I did sell it, was KitSwap.
KitSwap?
Because I am into soccer, and in Europe, they call them kits. Hmm. For the uniforms, in particular the shirts or whatever. And I was like, oh, cool, I'm going to, you know, whatever, 15 years ago, I was going to build some shirt swapping site very specific to that domain. Bought this and sat on it, as we all do with many domains.
Oh, yeah.
Never did really anything with it. And there you go. So, yeah, I eventually sold it.
I had a domain for a while. It was Emoji Coin. Because before the idea of NFTs ever existed, I was just like, what if there's like a coin where it's like there's only a finite number of Santa Clauses and you're trading these things around? And it might have flown, honestly, but I could never, I don't know, take it seriously enough. I was kind of blown away when the whole NFT thing took off. And I'm like, that Emoji Coin idea I had wasn't like that crazy, actually.
And you still have it or no?
I don't know. I'll have to look.
Probably yes.
Probably not.
Yeah.
So I was trying to dig for interest in other dirt and whatever. Not dirt, anyway. That's the wrong way to put it.
Yeah.
The other interests.
Dirt.
And I saw a lot of Bitcoin posts in your Twitter past. And so obviously you've had some interest in Web3 technologies and blockchain and all of that. Is that somewhere in your head still? Or you kind of moved on? Or
yeah. No, it's definitely a big part of my consciousness, I think. I'm a bit of a maximalist, a Bitcoin maximalist. I mean, it's not to the extreme where I would say, like, nothing else of value can ever be built on cryptographic distributed consensus protocols. But more just like, I'm so much more excited about Bitcoin than any of the other stuff. The other stuff is just like, it's kind of interesting, or that's a fun idea. Whereas Bitcoin's actually pretty meaningful to me. And it really roots back to, like, I don't know, really young age where I'm just like, what is money again? Like, how does this work? And like, one of my first jobs was like writing. It was like in the lead up to the 2008 crisis. I like worked for a mortgage company writing these scripts that would like send their data out of their terrible database that God knows how I even got data out of it. To Countrywide home loans and, you know, these terrible files with tildes in them. But, you know, that was really when questions started to swirl around, like, how does this all work? And what I love about Bitcoin is it's just
they
like,
I didn't know.
Nobody knows. Yeah. And it just seems...
Trust them. Trust them.
Yeah. I mean, and there are really intelligent people who think that it's all above board and it all makes sense. But to me, the whole credit-driven system, this idea that like I work hard to be paid whatever I'm paid per hour, and then there's some other participants in the system that just get to conjure those units out of nothing. Now, if they carried some risk for doing that, like that'd be one thing, but it kind of seems like they don't, because there's moral hazard involved where they get to conjure the units, and then when that goes awry, then they're bailed out anyway. Mm-hmm. And so like,
mm-hmm.
if money represents human labor multiplied by time, you know, attention, human something, effort times time, then I don't know. To me, it just doesn't seem ethical. Like, obviously, like chattel slavery in the South was this horrific, brutal thing. But there's something akin to it of like slavery is sort of taking someone's labor from them in a non-consensual way. And to me, like the process of being able to inflate the money supply, the seniorage awarded by that is just not honest. Mm. It enables the government to operate in a way where they're not asking for tax revenue, like directly. They're kind of backdooring it and putting it off. And like, so anyway, I just like a system where it's like no human gets to decide. And that was gold. But the problem with gold is I can't beam, you know, $20 worth of gold from here to Australia in 3 seconds.
Right.
Yeah.
This sounds like its own podcast, actually.
Yeah. Sorry. I get a little ranty about it.
No.
And okay.
I don't discredit, dislike, or any of those things what you're talking about, because I think we could go on for another hour about that just okay. specifically.
Yeah.
If you happen to be in Atlanta later this month, I think we should talk in person about that. But
okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Are you going to Render?
Yeah. Are you going to Render?
I'm not. I don't even know what Render is. Tell me.
Render ATL. It's a conference in Atlanta.
Yeah. And it's huge.
Cool.
There's like everyone ever speaking there. So
yes,
like 80 plus speakers or something.
Damn.
I encourage you to come just to hang out. We're going to go because we're like, we got to go and hang out.
That sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you don't have plans.
The funny thing about me is like, this is one area where I definitely need to level up, is I just am so like grinding all the time, right? Like heads down grinding, building. Mm-hmm. That I don't even know what this conference is that everyone's going to and 80 people are speaking at of note. Like, I didn't even know what that was.
That's okay. That's why you get shit done and we talk on a podcast and drink whiskey. So, you know.
But honestly, I do need to fucking tell people this thing exists, right?
Right.
Excuse my language. Maybe you could bleep that out.
No, you're fine. We are unedited.
No.
Okay.
This is an alcohol-fueled discussion.
Okay.
So we encourage profanity because it's natural language to a degree, right?
Yeah.
And you're not like applying for a job here or something, whatever, or asking for funding.
Inverse a binary tree.
Yes. Hurry up and do it now. So I'm going to go into some whatnot here because I know we're like starting to push time and whatever else.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just guide me.
One thing is one of our inspirations for this podcast is the Hot Ones YouTube show.
Okay.
Right. Under duress, increasingly like interesting and difficult questions. And so the more whiskey you drink, and then we ask you things, and then we get off the rails and we curse and we start to talk about the money system and trust and whatever else.
What's your question here, Chuck?
So I just wanted to state that first. And then my question is, you mentioned Italy earlier.
I'm scared.
Italy?
Oh yeah.
No. I want to go down the path of Italia.
See.
Ciao. Right. Cause I've spent a lot of time there. You have a lot of friends and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, one day wouldn't mind making it a home, but or at least a temporary home.
Same.
Right. Oh, okay. Well, then we've got a whole thing. We can like go down there.
Yeah, I'll live there if you're there.
That's all it takes. Someone to set you up and speak the language.
Well, no, I would like to live there, but like I need people that aren't Italian to hang out with.
Yeah, right. Well, all my friends speak English, so that's helpful.
Yeah.
We have some friends in Como who have kids the same age as us. So it's like very appealing to us to like bring your kids there. And then you have someone that's helped foster some comfort for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what. Yeah. I love going there. I've been to a bunch of vineyards there and traveled around multiple times. It's a kind of regular haunt for me, but like tell me a little about your time in Italy and what you love and where you like to be.
Well, I mean, a big part of my connection to Italy is Antonio, who's one of my co-founders of Zed.
Oh, yes.
What?
My new best friend.
And so, I mean, I loved Italy before Antonio, but he's definitely deepened my love of it and visiting him and like, yeah.
Where does he live?
He lives in I'm probably mispronouncing it and he would correct me, Gambettola, which is in Romagna, which is about an hour-ish south of Bologna. I'm actually visiting him. We're getting an Airbnb in Bologna.
Mm.
And I'm just going to like, yeah, last time I went to visit him, I did not eat for 3 days to make room to just like destroy food while I was there and not even worry about it.
Yeah, well, for sure.
It worked out perfectly. Other than I arrived and he's like, I have not even heard you finish a sentence without mentioning food.
Oh, other than.
So it kind of put a damper on me as a conversation partner until we got the plate of salami and cheese. But anyway.
You know, what's funny is that most times that I've been there, I can just eat my, we'll eat like pizza and gelato every day and obviously lots of pasta and whatever else. I usually lose weight.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's just based on.
Because they don't put chemicals in there. Like it's real food.
Yes, because it's just real food in normal portions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like not a big deal to just eat without having a problem. So.
Well.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Yeah. My wife is lactose intolerant. Oh. She goes there, eats cheese every day. Not a problem.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
It's an alternate dimension, clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. I speak German. They didn't offer Italian in high school, nor would I probably have elected it.
Right.
They offered French, German, and Spanish, and everybody took Spanish.
Yeah.
And German just seemed interesting, like weird, you know, like, but someday I would love to learn Italian. I tell Antonio, I'm going to learn Italian. And then I last like 2 weeks and freaking Duolingo or whatever. And then I'm like, oh shit, I actually have a lot going on in my life.
Yeah.
And this is a lot right now.
Yeah.
But I would love to speak it. And I agree.
The problem is when they actually think you do speak it. Like we did that. Like, so we went to Italy for our honeymoon and we thought we learned it for a while and like went to a restaurant and like got our way to the table without them knowing that we didn't speak Italian. Oh, no. And then like the waiter's speaking to us in Italian nonstop. And we're like, I'm sorry, you've just got to like, you got to stop. We don't know what you're saying anymore.
Yeah. Apologies. But you know, we're this is where it ends.
It's hard.
It is. It's a difficult language. My wife actually took Italian in college. And so she, you know, when we go there, she does most of the driving or we're with friends who speak English and it's fine. Doesn't matter. But I always have on my bucket list. Like, I want my Italian friends to respect me more. And if I had more of this, it would help. And my wife would just enjoy it because she loves Italian. It's like, you know, it was like a dream come true for her. Yeah.
If you had a wine podcast, they would respect you more than if you had a whiskey podcast, I think.
Well, they don't drink a ton, to be honest. I mean, yes, they have some wine or whatever. Yeah.
I don't have wine with every meal.
Yeah, but like one, maybe two glasses, and that's kind of the end of it. Like social drinking is very much less a thing there than it is here, and definitely more, you know, less so than England. In England, you're just constantly pounding drinks no matter what. And in Italy, it'll be like, they'll put out, you know, they might like on a like casual social and you put out a liter of beer for a table of four and people share that and have a little, you know, a little bit of it and talk and whatever else. And they're like, bibbidi boobity bobbity, you know, there. And that happened. That's for sure. And yeah, this happens.
The hands talking. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
You know, an area of alcohol that I think is really interesting, I don't know a ton about it, but I know a little, is Amaros.
Oh.
Like, so interesting.
I know a lot about Amaros. You just
get so excited.
Boom. That's like probably my other favorite spirit. And I've had a ton of different ones and I've made limoncello myself. And
oh, wow.
Which is actually considered a part of like Amaros. There's like Amaros, Amaris, and, you know, there's things with herbs, things with just fruits and stuff. And they're all kind of in the same boat of things. It's amazing. I've been, Campari is an Amaro.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of.
I like Amaro Nonino.
Yep.
That's one I've had that I like.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another one.
Fernet is a big one.
Oh, yeah, of course.
That's huge in Argentina, originated in Italy, but yeah.
And there's like Aperol, which is kind of like the Bud Light of Amaro, probably, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I like those Aperol spritz.
I like Aperol.
Yeah, the spritzes are nice. Yeah, yeah.
They're good. There's no shame.
I can't tell you how many like happy hours where you can get an Amaro spritz or a Negroni, and then they have all this food out, and that just became dinner for me a number of times.
Oh, yeah.
It was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy. You order one drink, and they give you like 8 plates of food, and you're like, wait, what? It comes with all this?
Yeah. I volunteered in Milan for a couple of weeks, and it was like oftentimes that was dinner, and then we go get gelato.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we have a couple of drinks, all this food. Now let's just get the dessert. Who cares?
Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a different world.
So when you went to wineries in Italy, which region were you in?
We were mostly in Tuscany. We've been to a few all over Chianti. The place, but mostly in Tuscany. So our favorite is one.
Oh, not Chianti?
Yeah, they had some other things there. It's called Avognonese. In Tuscany.
Oh, yeah. The one that's San Giovese, like with letters taken out and rearranged.
Yes. And they're an organic winery, but it was the first organic wine that I ever had that didn't taste like absolute garbage. It's amazing. And they have the whole thing where they like designed one of their vineyards where it's like a tree in the center and it's all this big circle.
Oh, that's thing. Cool.
And all the vines grow out from there, and they have a whole horticultural reason for this. But and they rotate it around basically to like...
I love that.
Yeah, it's really neat. So this place, yeah, I love that place. And we did like a whole food thing there too. So we had like a 6-course thing with trying all these different wines and stuff to it. And yeah.
And you never sent me any wine.
It's at my house. Come get it.
All right. I'll get on a flight right after this.
We had our first, when we were just like Antonio, Max, and Nate, they started designer. Max is my other co-founder. We all visited and stayed at this little inn in kind of outside of Asti, and just I drank a lot of Barbera. It was really, really fun. Mm. So yeah, that's the area that I'm more familiar with is like the...
Did you have any Hannah with your Barbera?
I think maybe.
Hanna-Barbera?
Hannah. Okay.
Oh my God.
That's a cartoon.
Wait, that's an American winery probably.
It's a whole, you know, oh, like... Boy. Well, what is the bear and I don't know.
Yogi?
Huckleberry Hound and Yogi Bear and yeah, hey boo boo. Anyway.
Yeah.
We really devolved this conversation. That's how we know this is working.
Yeah, the real wine around there that's like the, you know, the fancy wine is the Nebbiolo, which I also think is really good. But I like Dolcetto, just like tossing it back. Anyway, I don't know. I'm not picky.
You know what I love about being there is that you can get amazing Lambrusco all over the place. Lambrusco is really good, but the problem is it's a young wine and doesn't ship well and doesn't sit on shelves well and all that. So Rio Nitti is garbage and like...
That's a really good point.
Yeah. Lambrusco all over the place. Super good. Like great summer wine. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it.
We are way over time though. So we're going to have to talk more wine another time. Before we end, is there anything we missed about Zed or anything you want to plug before we end?
I mean, we just landed Copilot support. I'm excited about language models generally. So that's another thing that's heavy in the mix on our roadmap is getting language models more involved in what it's like to code in Zed. We're in open beta. Give us a try. I would appreciate if you click the little message in the status bar and send us your feedback, even if you decide this isn't ready for me yet. It's missing X, Y, or Z, or I don't like this. We want to hear it. It will go into our giant digester in the sky, but then we just drill down in and read specific stuff. So it'd be super helpful to us. So yeah, I don't know. Anything else? Any other questions? I guess we're over time, so no.
Yeah. All right.
Only offline. That's it.
Yeah. Thanks everybody for listening. If you liked it, please subscribe, leave us some ratings and reviews. We appreciate it, and we will catch you next time.
5 stars.
Thanks for listening to Whiskey Web and Whatnot. This podcast is brought to you by Shipshape and produced by Podcast Royale. If you like this episode, consider sharing it with a friend or two and leave us a rating, maybe a review, as long as it's good.
You can subscribe to future episodes on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. For more info about Shipshape and this show, check out our website at shipshape.io.